I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Recent Advances in Hematologic Oncology. This is a four-part live webinar series we're doing, reviewing what happened at the ASH meeting. It's a follow-up to the four satellite meetings we did during the ASH virtual meeting. And we're going to start out focused on AML, acute myeloid leukemia today. We have an outstanding faculty. Doctors Pollier, Stein, and Wei are going to comment on ASH and beyond. If you're into audio podcasts, check out our new series, Oncology Today, interviews with clinical researchers, including a recent program we did with Dr. Keith Pratz on AML and FLT3 mutations. We're doing webinars almost every day now. But today we're here to talk about AML and in particular what happened at the ASH meeting. Here's where we're heading. Of course, our work is always oriented around the general medical oncologist and community-based practice. So, of course, we're going to emphasize the older patients and new and exciting approaches to those, as well as other developments in the management of AML. But before we get started, I just want to sort of take a step back and ask the faculty for their thoughts in terms of where we're heading. I'm going to start out with you, Andrew, and find out where you think we might be next year at the ASH meeting. I imagine it might be at least partially virtual, but who knows what's going to happen nowadays. But I'm just kind of curious what you're looking forward to seeing, not just at ASH, Andrew, but other meetings and publications, trials that are maturing, new agents that are being evaluated. What are you most excited about, Andrew? What are you looking forward to see over this next year?
Well, I think we've certainly been blessed by many new drugs which have come into the realm. And I think the next few years will be spent trying to sort out what's the best way to use these drugs, which patients are the right ones to use them for, what biomarkers can help us identify who will have the best response. And also, I think in time, what are the novel mechanisms of resistance that are likely to emerge, which are going to be quite distinct from previous chemotherapy? Where does the role of transplantation still fit in? And also, what's the use of MRD with these various drugs with respect to different targets and different molecularly identifiable lesions?
Any new drug or strategy, Andrew, that you're particularly excited about?
So obviously, we have a number of agents which are on the cusp of approval currently in registration studies, and probably the most interesting ones would be magrolimab, and obviously looking for the maturation of these phase 3 studies to see whether they will actually improve and change the natural history of the diseases will be important, and other drugs which are more molecularly targeted like menin inhibitors, there's a new RA-alpha agonist, etc. So a lot of new drugs coming, a lot of new drugs already in play, and how we're going to use them all is going to be the big question.
So, Eitan, I feel like we've been kind of scrambling around the last 2 years just to try to figure out what's been happening here with all the new agents, targeted therapy, venetoclax combinations. Now it seems like we're getting a chance to take a breath for a second, but it sounds like a new wave could be on the way. What are some of the things you're looking forward to seeing, both new agents as well as maybe, you know, phase 3 or correlative studies in AML? Eitan, what are you looking forward to see?
Yeah, so I would echo a little bit what Andrew was saying about the menin inhibitors. I'm very excited about those compounds for MLL rearranged leukemias and NPM1 mutant leukemias. I'm really excited also about seeing whether we're going to be able to use the combination of hypomethylating agents and venetoclax in younger patient populations. If I had my crystal ball, I would say that 5 years from now, which of course I don't, but 5 years from now, we might be using azacitidine and venetoclax for a lot of patients as induction chemotherapy or induction therapy in place of 7+3. And I think that's where the field is going. And then again, how are we going to mix and match all of these agents? We have this plethora of drugs, and now we have to figure out how to give them in combination and in sequence. A lot of work cut out for us.
So you were actually mentioned, I had never heard of menin inhibitors until you mentioned it a few minutes ago, Eitan, and I know there was some stuff presented at ASH. We have tons of ASH abstracts in the slide set. Please feel free to look through them. We're probably not going to get to all of them, but, you know, can, you know, help you check out what happened at ASH. But what about, how do these menin inhibitors work, Eitan, and what do we know about it right now?
Yeah, so just, I mean, to dive very briefly into it, menin is a protein that is thought to be very important in the pathogenesis of acute leukemias where there is a rearrangement in the mixed lineage leukemia gene, so 11q23 abnormalities and an NPM1 mutant leukemias, and perhaps in other subsets of leukemias. And the preclinical data, I think the important thing here is that we often see a lot of preclinical data on novel agents. And a lot of the preclinical data that we see is, not great. This preclinical data that's published on these menin inhibitors is really outstanding. It's outstanding work done by a variety of translational and basic investigators at a wide variety of academic institutions. And I think what's most exciting is that at least the early look at the clinical data shows that in relapse refractory AML with MLL rearrangements, which are really, really a very difficult type of AML and ALL to treat, these drugs have profound activity as single agents. And if that's really true, it opens up the door to all sorts of combinations one could think about. You know, we're still early on. Hopefully we'll get some updates at ASCO and ASH next year. But these drugs, I would say, this class of drugs is going to make a big splash down the road.
Interesting. You know, it's funny, when I first saw you, I thought that was a picture of New York behind you, but I guess that's a window.
That's really New York behind me.
You got a nice view there, Eitan. So, Dan, what are your thoughts moving forward? Eitan was talking about venetoclax combinations in younger patients. I can remember the interview I did, the first time I heard about venetoclax combination was an interview I innocently walked into with you, and it really opened my eyes. I think you presented a patient who had a 3-year remission. I'm like, what? Anyhow, that seems like a long time ago. I think it's only like 2.5 years ago. Right, but anyhow, yeah. Dan, what are you excited about, both in terms of venetoclax, but also, you know, other strategies and agents?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, picking up a little bit where Eitan left off, I think I agree that the venetoclax HMA regimens are going to continue to sort of ooze on out of where they're, you know, trying to be kept with the current label into a variety of different uses. One of those would be, you know, the younger and fit patients for intensive chemotherapy. But as we sort of, see that develop, it's going to become even more critical to understand who are the patients that don't respond to venetoclax, because, you know, that's 30-ish percentage of patients. We're really happy with the very nice response rates, but, you know, there's still a significant minority of patients that don't respond. So, you know, looking ahead the next year, a couple years, I think it's going to come down to a lot of risk stratification. What are the risk factors that that predict for a good response to venetoclax-based regimens, but also the not-so-good responses, so that we have more ways to guide some of these new therapies, like Eitan was talking about with menin inhibitors. I mean, there may be more logical fits for some of those therapies in those places where venetoclax is less likely to work. So I think that's one development things could take.
Andrew, I remember in the lecture that you did that we posted as part of the satellite, you were going into a lot of mechanisms, particularly in terms of resistance to venetoclax combinations. What are some of the things, again, that you're looking forward to learning about both primary resistance as well as patients who develop secondary resistance in terms of BCL2 inhibitors?
Well, we know that pro-survival mechanisms are not unique to cancer, and that it's a canonical pathway present in all cells, all living cells. And so obviously there's many safeguards against protecting normal cells from dying, and that's why there are at least 5 pro-survival molecules which are in existence. So what we're trying to do now is understand which pro-survival molecules are most critical or most addicted by a particular cancer, and then can a small molecule that specifically targets that, possibly in combination with another drug, then tip the cancer, which is ready to die, into a state of actual apoptosis. And so resistance mechanisms are obviously on target. That is, you can have a mutation in the actual target, like we see in CLL with respect to BCL2 inhibitors. However, that hasn't been so commonly identified in AML so far. Then you have basically upregulation of parallel survival pathways, like upregulation of BCLX or MCL1, as a way of trying to escape the on-target activity of pro-survival molecules. And Ash just gone, we also presented a new mechanism which was downstream of the BH3 pro-survival interaction, which was mutations in a protein called BAX or BAX, which is actually a convergence of all the anti-apoptotic activity of the BH3 mimetics. They have to go through BAX and BAC in order to affect cell death. And we actually found that in 14% of patients who had been on venetoclax for a period of time, that BAX was mutated, resulting in its inactivity and then abrogating the actions of BH3 mimetics, not only BCL2 inhibitors, but other inhibitors. And so this could be like a convergence pathway that could affect the activity of BH3 mimetics. And we did not find this in a control group of patients who had chemo resistance, where BAX mutations were not identified.
Yeah, we're doing a symposium on lung cancer, and what you're just talking about reminds me of some of the discussions you hear there about looking for resistance mutations in patients progressing on targeted therapy. Any anti-BAX strategies out there, Andrew?
There are antibodies which have been developed which can activate BAX, but whether they will overcome a BAX mutation, which results in the inability of the BAX to either be activated or to insert into the outer mitochondrial membrane, I think this may be a difficult problem to overcome. And so we need to find parallel or non-BAX dependent mechanisms to, I think, perhaps overcome that.
And Neil, we've stumbled also on some interesting mechanisms of potential resistance to venetoclax, and it's through a sort of the non-canonical pathway around BCL2. But what we found as a really strong predictor for a poor response to venetoclax is the presence of AML with monocytic disease features. So what we used to call the FAB classification system, which no one uses anymore, but the M5 category, when we retrospectively look at our patients who don't respond, they are extremely enriched in the patients that have those monocytic disease features. And so we've been looking at explanations for this, but there's also some fairly logical ways to target monocytic leukemia. There was a poster at ASH looking at this a clinical trial in progress, a target called LILRB4 that's shared on the monocytic disease population, that we're really excited to see if that could be a way to potentially someday overcome, you know, the resistance of the monocytic disease features to venetoclax-based regimens.
So I'm having such a good time. I'm kind of thinking we shouldn't even show slides. Just talk to the three of you for an hour. I mean, our whole work was always based on rounds. I can only imagine trying to make rounds with the three of you. Dan, just one follow-up to what you were just saying. Just kind of curious. I remember in that first interview, you brought up the idea of venetoclax affecting stem cells and whether you still think that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's work going back 10 years showing that BCL2 is a stem cell target in myeloid malignancies. And, you know, we've been able to show that now in vivo. The mechanism is really fascinating. Again, it's not the canonical pathway around BCL2 with the emphasis on promoting survival and disrupting that, but instead this really fascinating interaction between BCL2 and the BCL2 pathway in metabolism. And we found that it was well known before we started this that there was a particular Achilles heel of the leukemia stem cell population, specifically in the way they metabolize energy and a particular weakness that they had. We found that the venetoclax plus azacitidine really specifically impairs that one modality of metabolism. And you have such redundancy in other normal healthy cells built in where they can compensate for this. But for reasons we still don't really understand, leukemic stem cells are completely inflexible in terms of being able to metabolize energy. And so when you take that away, those cells die, and you can preferentially target the leukemic stem cells in that way. And this is part of the reason why we think that there are some patients who have such durable responses to this treatment, because you're impacting or eradicating the stem cell population.
Anything new, Dan, in terms of this strategy and other cancers, including solid tumors? I know venetoclax being looked at in breast cancer. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I've heard some things about that, and even, you know, some folks at my institution, and, you know, we're also siloed in our own little, you know, worlds. I there's a definite literature around some commonalities for cancer stem cells in general that share this this metabolic inflexibility. And so I would be really curious to see if this or another strategy to exploit that weakness could be effective in solid tumors as well.
So I want to bring up a clinical question that came up in the chat room. But first, just to go back to you, Andrew, in terms of what Dan was just talking about in terms of stem cells, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, stem cells are obviously the critical last frontier in terms of trying to cure patients with any disease, especially AML. And what we need to do is to find how can we affect death in a leukemic stem cell, but not wipe out normal progenitors, because that's what we do when we do a stem cell transplant, is just to try and get rid of everything, but not in a specific manner. I think leukemic stem cells and their survival dependency will probably be a combination of cell of origin issues, but also what mutations and also epigenetic changes which are occurring, which ultimately funnel down and result in determining which pro-survival pathways are most important. And so we now have small molecules, obviously, against BCL2, but there are also clinical molecules which can target BCLX, and also studies in progress targeting MCL1, and also preclinical studies looking at BFL1 or A1 inhibitors as well. And so we will eventually have, I think, in the clinic, small molecules to target all of these pro-survival entities. And it then gives us the opportunity of using these drugs either alone or in combination with each other or in combination with other novel drugs, for instance, targeting mutations. And I think that process will give us the keys to unlocking the ability to target cancer stem cells specifically once we can link biology with our therapeutic toolkits.
So, Eitan, I have no question that the most common query we get from general medical oncologists about AML is what I saw pop into the chat room about 3 minutes after we started, which is, when do I do the first bone marrow in a patient who's azacitidine venetoclax, and how do I manage the patient who's cytopenic at the first cycle? Actually, Andrew has a fantastic discussion of this with some really great algorithmic slides. But Eitan, can you just sort of verbally talk about this very common question, very common situation?
Yeah, and that's a great point you bring up, because, you know, azavenetoclax or HMA venetoclax is a fantastic treatment, but it requires attention to detail, and it requires attention to each particular patient and how their counts are recovering. So what we do at Memorial Sloan Kettering is that on day 28 of the first cycle, so at the end of the first cycle, we do a bone marrow biopsy. If that patient has cleared their blast from their bone marrow, we hold all therapy until the patient has some sort of count recovery, and we don't restart therapy until the time of count recovery. There are some centers I'm aware that do that bone marrow biopsy. Instead of doing it at day 28, they do it at day 21, and they will hold therapy based on the results of that bone marrow biopsy that's done at day 21. I think either way is probably okay. In the clinical trial, it was done at day 28. I think the key here is that it is a mistake to hammer the patient with repeated cycles of azacitidine and venetoclax on a Q4-week schedule like clockwork without giving them time for count recovery. And you also have to think about how you're going to reduce the duration of your venetoclax if the patient has continued myelosuppression. So I commonly, after the first cycle, if a patient is in a complete, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but if a patient is in a complete remission, and specifically if they're MRD negative, I will drop the duration of the venetoclax to 14 days instead of doing 28 days, because most patients really can't tolerate or don't need that much venetoclax in order to maintain that remission and to keep them from becoming myelosuppressed and getting febrile neutropenia and thrombocytopenia.
Dan, anything you want to add to that? I know you see a lot of second opinions. You're seeing people who are getting managed in the community. Any misperceptions, things people do that maybe you wouldn't do in terms of keeping people on azavenetoclax?
Yeah, I think Eitan summarized it very, very nicely. And I think that's really the key is breaks between treatment cycles, potentially consider growth factors when patients are in a remission. And I think that's really been the key for us to getting patients through this treatment. I think the biggest misperception or, that I see is a fear that this is, akin to intensive chemotherapy regimens with respect to its myelosuppressive properties. And, what I want to discourage people from thinking there is that that is the case. When managed properly, this can be, a therapy that you can adhere to and continue a patient on for quite a while. And the other difference is just that in the setting of this type of a therapy, cytopenias are less clinically significant than in the setting of intensive induction chemotherapy. And here I'm specifically talking about infectious complications. So just the presence of neutropenia, for instance, is not the same, should not cause the same degree of concern for infectious complications that it does in the setting of intensive chemotherapy. We could have a great discussion about why that is. I'm not saying to be glib about it or to be cavalier. You can still get into trouble, but it really isn't the same thing. Sometimes I hear people talking about how this really should be considered an intensive therapy, and I just couldn't disagree more.
So, Andrew, I think this case in the chat room might be relevant to you. It's from Vladimir, and who ends the question by saying, what do you do today? He doesn't want to hear about trials. He wants to know an off-trial therapy. But I think it's interesting. He says, what do you do? But anyhow, it's amazing that, we're doing this thing here. Anyhow, here's the situation, Andrew. Younger patient with AML, very fit, eligible for chemo, has a TP53 mutation complex karyotype. We actually have a poll question on that later, but let's just talk about it now because this came up. What are the options in that situation, Andrew, and what do you do as this person says?
Sure. Obviously, this is one of the most challenging patients that we face, a patient with complex karyotype, many of which have P53 mutations, I think, present in about 60%. So if it's a fit young person, basically for all of these patients at this stage, taking them to transplant is really our only long-term option. The question is how to get them there and how to get the highest proportion of patients to transplant in remission. So I think if it's a young patient, I still feel that intensive chemotherapy is appropriate and the right thing to do because we have a high, reasonably high level of true CRs. In patients that will have more complications from intensive chemotherapy, older people and those with comorbidities, then obviously venetoclax plus azacitidine does have a role. In patients with P53 mutation, the response rate CR/CRI is 55%, but we do know that relapse is almost inevitable in those patients. And so after achieving response, we still need to do something. So whenever the transplant is available, be it after the first cycle or subsequent cycles, I think taking that type of patient to transplant, even if they're older, if there's a reduced intensity option, is the right thing. There's also obviously CC486 as a maintenance therapy for some people that can't have an allogeneic transplant. But at this stage, we don't have molecular subgroup data as to whether this is going to improve long-term outcomes.
So, Eitan, there are a bunch of papers and there are trials now looking at adding venetoclax to chemotherapy. Here's one from ASH, a phase 2 study on this slide here, venetoclax added to cladribine and low-dose Ara-C. Can you just talk a little bit globally about this idea? We were talking before about maybe venetoclax, azacitidine, either replacing, preceding, or whatever in younger patients. But what about the idea of adding in venetoclax to chemo?
Yeah, so certainly it makes a lot of sort of preclinical sense to do such a thing. I think the issue that comes up, and when we look at these studies, you're showing some studies here, but when we look at these studies where you add venetoclax to chemotherapy, the response rates are invariably very, very high. I think the big issue here is when you add anything on that's got myelosuppressive capability to true induction chemotherapy, are you going to cause more harm by causing more deaths and aplasia than you are helping patients? In the old days, it's sort of funny that I can talk about the old days, but in the old days we used to give, everyone tried to add on a third cytotoxic chemotherapy agent to 7 and 3. And all those studies in general were a failure because they might have caused higher remission rates, but they caused more deaths. And the question is going to be, is venetoclax going to help in this situation, or is it going to go the way of those old studies where you added in a third agent that's myelosuppressive?
So just real quick, Eitan, I see you responded to somebody in the chat room who was asking about antifungal prophylaxis and using venetoclax combination. Do you use it? And also, do you modify dosing if you do use it, Eitan?
Yeah, so we do use it in our center for patients who are neutropenic. If you're not neutropenic, we don't use it. The important thing to note is that you have to modify. If you're using a strong CYP3A4 inhibitor like voriconazole or posaconazole, you've got to modify the dose of venetoclax. The FDA label says 100 milligrams for vori, 70 milligrams for posa. We do 100 milligrams for both. But I think the point that Dan brought up before is important because, you know, it is unclear whether the rates of fungal infection with this agent or with this myelosuppressive regimen are going to be similar to what you see with cytotoxic chemotherapy, where maybe the mucosal toxicity of cytotoxic chemotherapy is certainly higher than any mucosal toxicity with azacitidine venetoclax. So an open question, but I do give fungal prophylaxis.
So Andrew, when we were chatting before we got started, I was saying, what do you think some of the issues are that are most relevant, particularly to the general medical oncologist? And all three of you were talking about targetable lesions. Before you get into that, though, quick question from the chat room. Andrew, benefit of allo in primary refractory disease in a 50-year-old?
Primary refractory disease after intensive chemotherapy in a 50-year-old. Generally, we find that a difficult situation. There is some old literature suggesting 20 to 30% longer term survival rate in that situation. And so primary refractory is still potentially a transplantable situation, whereas early relapse, I find, is even a more difficult and challenging situation, where the benefit of allografting for early relapse within the first 3 months, I think, is still unclear.
So, Andrew, we saw this paper at ASH, and we've seen plenty of them looking at the issue of older patients with FLT3 mutations. Do you use a FLT3 inhibitor as part of the initial therapy? Do you combine it with venetoclax and azacitidine? What do we know about this, and any thoughts about what was presented at ASH in that regard, Andrew?
Yeah, this is a really fascinating area because FLT3 mutations do occur in older people, albeit with lower frequency than younger people. We know that after venetoclax-based therapies, that FLT3 mutations can be a cause of emergent resistance, with clones being selected and increasing in terms of their size at the time of progression. We also know that not all FLT3 mutations are the same, and this paper suggests that although responses are very high for patients with both FLT3 TKD and also ITD mutations, at least in subgroup analyses from the VIALE-A trial, patients with a FLT3 TKD mutation do seem to have a benefit in terms of venetoclax in addition to AZA in terms of survival. But patients with FLT3 ITD, on the other hand, do not have a clear benefit. And so that leaves us with the question, how do we further optimize therapy for patients with FLT3 ITD? Should we use gilteritinib as a frontline agent? Well, we have some top-line data suggesting that the Lacewing study, which was trying to examine this in the phase 3 situation, apparently did not find a survival benefit and was closed early by the Data and Safety Monitoring Committee. Should we use a FLT3 inhibitor sequentially when the patient progresses? That's what we do. So if a patient fails Ven/Aza, we always look for a FLT3 mutation, even if it wasn't present at diagnosis, because it can emerge in some patients and make the patient amenable to a targeted therapy like gilteritinib. Should we use a novel combination such as a FLT3 inhibitor with venetoclax? And we might talk about that later. And lastly, should we look at the possibility of sequential therapy, that is, Ven/Aza interlaced with a FLT3 containing regimen, or pile all the drugs together in terms of what we call triplets? I think these are going to be the really interesting, exciting questions for the future.
So, Dan, you know, one of the interesting things to me about the venetoclax combination data that we saw early on was it seemed to work or be beneficial to patients regardless of, you know, sort of their workup and mutations, et cetera. And then we started to see that some patients actually did really well. And I think one of them was the people with IDH mutations. You presented some data on that at ASH. What did you find there, Dan?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think just backing up, I think, you know, there's different ways to assess, you know, a good response or what a response means. And I think with respect to just response rates, there are really no clear genomic or cytogenetic subsets that don't benefit from venetoclax-based regimen. And Andrew kind of just described that with respect to FLT3. You know, when we're talking about survival, that gets to be a different issue, and I think a more complicated one, and where, you know, things like P53 and potentially complex cytogenetics aren't, you know, don't do as well with venetoclax-based regimens as we might want them to. But back to your question about IDH, you know, it's really fascinating. Ever since the very first relapse refractory single agent venetoclax clinical trial, we noticed that there was a propensity for IDH positive patients to have better than average responses. And so we collated, you know, a really large group of patients from the VLEA study as well as the earlier phase two study, and looked at those patients with and without IDH mutations who got venetoclax plus azacitidine versus azacitidine alone. I mean, I think what it drives home is that, you know, everyone did better with the venetoclax combination. So, you know, IDH positive, IDH wild type didn't really matter. You know, the venetoclax subsets did better, but the IDH positive patients did seem to do even better than what we observed in the IDH wild type patients who got venetoclax based regimens. So I think, you know, presents a lot of really interesting, you know, future questions. First, I think, you know, you have a reliable therapy with a patient with an IDH mutation in the upfront setting with venetoclax, where, you know, you don't have to wait for the results to come back to, you know, decide on a therapy. But also more importantly, I think now that we can very clearly show this clinically, you know, I really want my, you know, laboratory-based and translational colleagues to really figure this out, because whatever the mechanism is that makes IDH positive patients respond so well to venetoclax, perhaps we can manipulate that in IDH wild type patients and make them respond even better to venetoclax. So, that's what's most exciting about this observation to me.
So, I mean, we could talk about venetoclax combinations all day long, but we're going to move on in a second to some other issues. But one other thing I just wanted to bring up, and I remember, Andrew, in the lecture that you did, the presentation, you brought up this drug, pacritinib, which we know in this phase three trial, I guess, didn't really work out compared to adding to azacitidine. But there's also this idea to combine it with venetoclax, and in this case, with this trial, with low dose ARA-C. Any thoughts about this drug and the possibilities in terms of adding it to venetoclax combinations, Andrew?
So HDAC inhibitors have been in clinical exploration for many years now. And really one of the major problems with HDAC inhibitors has been tolerability, particularly with respect to lethargy and other significant gastrointestinal side effects, particularly when it's combined with azacitidine. The reason we wanted to continue exploring HDAC inhibitors is that we were looking for drugs which work via a P53 independent mechanism. And we found that HDAC inhibitors in combination with venetoclax was extremely potent in preclinical settings and completely independent of P53 mutation presence. And so there are two key objectives from the trial. Firstly, is the combination of a HDAC inhibitor with a BCL2 inhibitor tolerable in the clinic? And second, would it work against poor risk patients? So we developed a trial where patients with adverse cytogenetic risk that will be enriched for P53 mutations would receive a backbone of low-dose ARA-C ven. And then in the second phase of the cycle, that is after the chemotherapy, combining the venetoclax with a HDAC inhibitor. We've opened a trial nationally in Australia. We've already done the first two cohorts, and we hope to maybe present the data later this year at ASH. But I think this is an area which hasn't fully closed the chapter yet. on HDAC inhibitors. And if we can demonstrate P53 independent activity, tolerability in a novel triplet, then maybe we could resurrect the possibility of HDAC inhibitors in the field of AML.
So Eytan, I want to talk a little bit about FLT3 inhibition and also in terms of what was presented at ASH. And one very practical issue, there are a couple of papers addressing, was the question of whether or not, you know, you can see responses to a FLT3 inhibitor, specifically gilteritinib, in patients who receive therapy with midostaurin or sorafenib. Any comments about what this is, what was reported here, Eytan, and in general, what your clinical experience is and other trial data on this important question?
Yeah, so this is really a crucial question, because when the ADMIRAL data, which demonstrated the benefit of gilteritinib in relapsed refractory FLT3 positive AML compared to placebo, was presented and then published, one of the criticisms was that it was already outdated, because nowadays, most patients who have FLT3 positive AML will get midostaurin in combination with chemotherapy up front. And the question becomes, well, if you give a targeted FLT3 inhibitor after you've already given midostaurin, is that going to work as well as if the patient never saw a FLT3 inhibitor beforehand? This data that was presented by Sasha Pearl and a few others in a retrospective fashion, compiling a number of trials together, really shows and I think demonstrates that, at least retrospectively, the administration of a prior FLT3 inhibitor does not influence the efficacy of gilteritinib in the relapse refractory setting in those patients. So in our practice, when we have a patient who's FLT3 mutated, who's received midostaurin and chemotherapy up front, we still give them gilteritinib as their salvage therapy, as their salvage inhibitor, unless we have a clinical study available for them.
And this is another paper from ASH on the same question, coming, I guess, to the same conclusion. Another thing that we're seeing with all these targeted therapies, Andrew, is trying to combine it with intensive chemotherapy. Any comments? This is Keith Pratz presented this phase one study combining gilteritinib with induction therapy, you know, as opposed to midostaurin. What did they see here, Andrew, and where do you see this heading?
So obviously, because of the approval of FLT3 inhibitors in the relapse refractory setting, the next frontier is to take it into the frontline setting in younger patients. What we know from a number of different explorations, be it gilteritinib or sorafenib or crenolinib or quizartinib, is that in combination with intensive chemotherapy in the frontline setting, high response rates will be achievable in patients, in younger patients. The question is whether that will translate into improved overall survival. And so there's a very, very large multinational trial led by the HOVON AML CG group looking at gilteritinib in the frontline setting. And I think this will be a fascinating study to look at the result of. There's also a frontline quizartinib study, which is due to be presumably read out in the next year or so, because I believe the recruitment for that is either completed or very close to being completed. At ASH, we also presented a randomized trial looking at sorafenib in combination with intensive chemotherapy or placebo with chemotherapy. And we were surprised that the response rate was very high with the FLT3 combination group, but it was also really high in the placebo group as well, suggesting that with modern chemotherapy, that high response rates can be achieved. Furthermore, we didn't see as huge a survival benefit as we had expected. And I think that's because transplantation in first remission is very high now in the standard of care setting. In our trial, it was 60%. And so this really nullified the potential benefit of the FLT3 inhibitor, except in patients with a very high FLT3 ITD allelic ratio. And so the question is fundamentally, in the first line setting, is the leukemia really dependent upon FLT3, or is this more of a feature in a patient with relapsed refractory disease where the FLT3 clone has been selected out? And I think these frontline studies will be incredibly enlightening.
Dan, any thoughts about, you know, the global strategy of integrating targeted therapy with intensive chemotherapy? And also curious about this paper from ASH, looking at venetoclax with gilteritinib in relapse disease. So two questions there.
Yeah, I mean, to the first question, I think, you know, we definitely have reason to be hopeful that moving these more targeted therapies into the upfront setting will bear fruit. I think that, you know, like Andrew described, I think the question you have to answer is, is your new targeted FLT3 inhibitor better than midostaurin in the upfront setting? So, you know, it's no longer acceptable to just show, you know, that you're better than 7+3. Since 2017, we have a new standard of care for FLT3 positive induction eligible patients that we're very comfortable with. So I think that's really going to be a key question, you know, and you know, that study, that randomized study, is something that each of these FLT3 inhibitors would need to add to the table. And, you know, and then, like Andrew said, also, you wouldn't expect a FLT3 inhibitor to improve response rates. Midostaurin didn't. That's not why FLT3 mutant patients do poorly. I mean, we can get them into a remission just fine with chemotherapy. So the key is, you know, what's the duration of response? What's the incidence of relapse? What's the survival? So those are really the key endpoints. And then as to the second question, you know, this is an appealing strategy on its surface to say that we're going to kind of take all the targeted therapies we have and you know, lump them all together up front. Andrew also touched on this strategy. You know, I'm not so sure that I think that that's the way forward. Again, you know, response rates for FLT3 positive patients who receive venetoclax are just as good as they are for FLT3 wild type patients. Andrew suggested that perhaps the FLT3 ITD patients have you know, a compromised survival. You know, the numbers were a little bit small. I think there's some suggestion of that. The way to overcome that, to me, would be much more appealing rather than giving everyone, you know, these large combinations in the upfront setting, is to wait, get people into a remission with venetoclax HMA, and then people who are MRD positive pulse in a therapy and perhaps a FLT3 inhibitor if that's appropriate, or another novel agent, or an IDH inhibitor. To me, that would be much better because, remember, you know, 20 to 30% of the Ven/Aza patients are coming out into this tail of the curve that's plateaued. And so, you know, those are patients that did just fine long-term with just the venetoclax hypomethylating agent. So adding other things into the mix really probably can only hurt them. And when you look at who those patients in the tail are, those patients have FLT3 mutations. There's a lot of IDH patients there too, but there's some FLT3 positive patients there. So, you know, FLT3 doesn't always drive this disease. Sometimes it's sort of a red herring. And so knowing, you know, treating MRD positive patients with a targeted therapy or any other therapy just seems like a more effective and better tolerated strategy to me going forward.
Really interesting. Andrew, what do you think about this paper combining venetoclax with gilteritinib? You know, they note that indirectly, it looks like, you know, you see a higher a response rate with the combination than they saw with just gilteritinib alone in the ADMIRAL trial. Any thoughts about that, Andrew?
I'm a real fan of combining a BH3 mimetic with a targeted drug, because the targeted drug is targeting something which is important to the cancer. And in the case of FLT3-ITD, FLT3-ITD may also drive pro-survival molecules which BCL2 can't target, like BCLX and MCL1. So for me, I quite like the selectivity of a targeted drug against the target and then enhancing the activity with a BH3 mimetic. In this paper by Naval Dava, response rates were 80+%, but you note there that most of the responses were MLFS or not full CR responses, and that's because of the possibility of myelosuppression also being a problem with this approach. And so what we have to do now is to work out what's the right dose and what's the right schedule of these drugs in combination. Do we need to give the venetoclax for the whole cycle, or should we perhaps truncate it to perhaps the first 2 weeks and allow some hematopoietic recovery? And so I think the strategy is the right one. The deliverability and the feasibility in terms of dose optimization is important. And so I think for these reasons, it's important to keep doing these things on a clinical trial rather than taking this out of the context of trials before we've actually worked out how to do this safely.
So I want to talk about IDH inhibitors and where they're fitting in nowadays. And again, reflecting back on ASH, Eitan, you had this paper looking at enasidenib monotherapy with the addition of azacitidine in non-responders in older patients. Can you talk a little bit about what you presented there?
Yeah, so this was part of the large BEAT-AML master trial. And it really gets to the question of, what's the best way to give these drugs? Do we give them in combination? Do we sequence them? And this study asked, well, what if you take patients who are IDH2 mutated, you start them out on a single agent IDH2 inhibitor, in this case, enasidenib, and then you look and you see if they respond or not. If they don't respond by the end of the fifth cycle, and you can then add on azacitidine and see if you get a response in that scenario. What was interesting was that we actually saw that this was a winning, or at least preliminarily, that it was a winning strategy. Because when we gave enasidenib monotherapy, about 50% of those patients ended up responding. These are the survival, but the responses were about 50% of the patients ended up responding. And then in those patients that didn't respond, those 17 patients you see up here who didn't respond, when you added on the azacitidine, about another 40% of those patients, 40 to 50%, responded with the addition of azacitidine. So what this does is it avoids the potential toxicity of giving a doublet until you know for sure that that doublet is needed. Just to make one more comment, you know, I think many of us have been told, you know, acute myeloid leukemia is going to become like multiple myeloma, where we're giving triplets and quadruplets and quintuplets and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a different disease, right? This is a disease which is characterized by a lot of issues with bone marrow suppression. And if your therapies are going to cause more bone marrow suppression as you add them on, I'm not so sure that that strategy is going to be good. And we should be thinking more about sequencing.
Andrew, any thoughts about this kind? I'm sorry, go ahead. Hey, Dan?
Real quick, just to add on one thing to Eitan. I mean, I couldn't agree with more. And also, you know, that example is so theoretical because, you know, it assumes that we have targeted therapies for every mutation, and we don't. And we're getting to maybe the end of the list of the genomically targeted therapies that we're going to have. So, you know, you can speak in theory about the patient with the FLT3 and the IDH mutation, but, you know, we're talking about single digit percentages, and we do spend a lot of our time talking about those patients and the theory of piling up all these therapies, these targeted therapies on top of each other, but that's just not the way the field is evolving.
So we have a whole bunch of practical clinical questions in our slide deck, but our conversation day sort of took off a little bit. We'll let you check out a lot of those after the fact. I think you'll find them very educational. But let me just go through one that I thought was particularly interesting. So, Andrew, here's a question we're going to ask the audience. Audience, 60-year-old patient with AML and IDH2 mutation who gets 7+3 induction consolidation and transplant and then has disease progression. What would you be thinking about next for a patient like that? Or what do you think a patient like that next you might want to be thinking about? And Andrew, it's interesting looking at the audit. Looks like the most common answer is HMA venetoclax. Some people say HMA venetoclax plus enasidenib. And people, of course, so say enasidenib alone. And this is interestingly, when we asked a faculty from the satellite and we asked several other docs, we saw a consensus, just kidding, it was kind of split between azacitidine and enasidenib. So Andrew, why did you say azacitidine?
Yes, this remains a difficult situation because we don't have data which gives us a definitive answer. So with respect to enasidenib, which is obviously the most attractive agent because it's oral, it's single agent, it's well tolerated, and the patient doesn't have to spend a whole bunch of time in hospital. However, we do know that a randomized trial in the setting of enasidenib versus conventional care regimens did not show a survival advantage with the enasidenib. And enasidenib as a single agent will give us a response rate of around 30%. So the caveat there was that that study was done for patients who needed enasidenib, I think, as the third or beyond line. And so the question is, if we did this in first failure, which is what you're presenting here, will we get a higher response rate? From the studies that we know, response rates for IDH inhibitors in the first failure setting are more towards the 50% range. And so that would be quite a reasonable option here. With respect to aza-ven, although studies in relapsed refractory disease haven't been done in a randomized setting, single-arm response rates are on the order of maybe 30 to 40%. Whether we would get an amplified response because of the potential sensitization of an IDH mutation to this combination, we do see that, but obviously these are in anecdotal settings. whether we should use venetoclax in combination with an IDH inhibitor. Certainly very promising data with ivosidenib, the IDH1 inhibitor, but I think trials in progress with respect to IDH2 in that combination.
So we've been saying for a while we try to go beyond the guidelines. The guidelines will say both of these options are, you know, have evidence to support them. But what we do is like, well, what do you do? And if everybody says the same thing, well, we call it a consensus. In a situation like this, we say, no, it's not a consensus. And I see both Dan and Eitan say enasidenib. Eitan, what are you thinking?
Well, you know, when I answered this question, it was in the setting of enasidenib being approved for this indication. It was for relapsed refractory IDH2 mutant AML. You know, as Andrew said, there was this press release that came out that said that the randomized phase 3 study of enasidenib versus conventional care regimens did not meet its primary endpoint. I would just sort of say to the audience, all 300 people on here, that it's really difficult to interpret data from a press release. And all we've seen is that press release. So I think we need to know a little bit more about, you know, which patients didn't respond. Were there issues with the way the trial was designed? But having said that, I would probably have a discussion with the patient about both options and engage in what we call shared decision making, which is a way of saying dump it in the patient's lap because I'm not sure what to do.
So yeah, that's what we call coin flipping. We're trying to ask the same question everybody's asking you all. And that sort of leads into our next topic, which is CC486. Andrew, can you talk a little bit about what you presented? Maybe just backtrack a little bit and remind people what this is, what we know about it before ASH, and then a little bit about these data you presented.
So CC486 is oral azacitidine, and this is a way of trying to deliver a hypomethylating agent in a more convenient format and also in an extended exposure format. So dose-finding studies show that you can give CC486 for usually 2 weeks, but can also be given for 3 weeks in each 28-day cycle. And so the 2-week schedule was found to be the most or best tolerated. And so this was taken into an international phase 3 study, which was performed and demonstrated, now published in New England, that CC486 given to patients aged 55 years and older, unfit for transplant, improved overall survival compared to a placebo arm. And so there are a number of abstracts at ASH trying to explore subgroup analyses as to how this drug works and in which setting it works best in. So the one shown here is, firstly, does CC486 work in patients who have not had any consolidation therapy? And secondly, what's the optimal number of consolidation therapies we should give before perhaps considering our CC486? So a couple of observations are, firstly, who are these patients that don't have consolidation therapy? In this study, about 20% of patients didn't have consolidation therapy. We did an analysis of our national registry data, and about 10% of patients over the age of 55 also just had induction chemotherapy. So in older people, there are a subpopulation of patients that really don't tolerate induction well, and the physicians feel that giving consolidation therapy is not safe or not justified. And so this study shows that giving CC486 improves survival in that population from 10 to 23 months in terms of median survival. The second question is, if you are going to give someone CC486, how many consolidations should you give? And so these abstracts also show that if you give 2 cycles of consolidation and then CC486, your median survival expectation is about 28 months, whereas if you give 0 or 1 consolidation, then the survival is progressively less. So not a randomized study to directly address this question, but if someone asked me what should I do, I would probably give induction, achieve remission, 2 consolidations, and then go on to CC486 as a maintenance strategy.
So just to follow up, Andrew, there was also a paper at ASH by Dr. Rabeaus. Dan was referring to MRD measurements, and this was a study, again, of CC486 from the QUASAR study, looking at how patients did based on MRD. Any comments on that, Andrew?
Yes, this was, I think, a landmark study because it told us many really exciting and interesting things. First of all, it told us that MRD in an older population done in a centralized clinical trial setting, one, was feasible. The collection rate was almost 100%, and it showed that MRD was a clear indicator of poor survival in these older patients. The second thing that this study found was that giving an agent, in this case CC4XC, could change the natural history of patients with MRD positivity and improve survival in that setting in a randomized prospective placebo-controlled trial. Third thing which this study also showed us was that you can give CC4X6 to patients who are MRD positive, and about 40% of them will become MRD negative. But it also told us that in the placebo arm, about 19% also achieved MRD negativity, hence showing the importance of having a controlled arm, because spontaneous MRD responses can occur. And so I think this collection of information is incredibly important, because it sets the stage for the possibility of using MRD as an endpoint in the future for further interventional studies.
So, Dan, if we use the term oral azacitidine, you know what question is going to be coming next, which is, can I just use it anytime I use azacitidine, particularly the idea of then an oral azacitidine, an all oral regimen, not to mention how oriented we are about keeping people out of the hospital nowadays. What do you think about that idea, Dan? Do we need more data, or can you do it now?
That's great, Neil. I'm glad you brought this up, because I feel really, really strongly about this. There's no data to support the use of oral azacitidine in other places where we use conventional azacitidine. And that's different than the decitabine approval. The oral decitabine approval is considered to be equivalent from a pharmacokinetic perspective, and they've done all the relevant studies to show that. The fact is that we don't really know what azacitidine does and how it works in all of these different settings. This drug, unlike the oral decitabine, CC46, has different pharmacokinetic properties. And so the extent to which conventional azacitidine works because of those properties, I would not want to impair a response by substituting out CC46 for conventional azacitidine, no matter how tempting that may be. So different answer for decitabine, and there are some clinical trials of oral decitabine with venetoclax, and I know some people are doing that. I would feel much better about that than given what we know now about the oral azacitidine CC46, but I think that is something we could see and hopefully will see in the future.
Eitan, any thoughts about an all-oral regimen, oral decitabine and venetoclax, particularly in situations where COVID's a problem, which is happening almost everywhere now, it seems?
Yeah, I would just echo everything that Dan said. I think oral decitabine and venetoclax is coming. As Dan said, those trials are being done now. And really, the trials are just trying to show that the pharmacokinetic properties of each drug remain the same when you mix them together in someone's stomach. And once that's shown, I think that we are going to be moving towards these all oral regimens. And I think that decitabine is going to get there first because of the unknowns about how CC486 compares to IV azacitidine or sub-Q azacitidine.
So let's breeze through a few other points. One we wanted to cover was CPX351. I've been interested since I first heard about this in terms of where it's heading. We started to see a little bit of that in terms of some of the stuff presented at ASH. Any comments, Andrew, about this paper that was presented at ASH with 5-year final follow-up of the phase 3 trial versus 7+3?
Yeah, so this study had 5-year median follow-up on all its patients now. And it was interesting because, as you can see here, it showed that the survival benefit of CPX351 was durable. One of the most interesting aspects of this study I found was that if you looked at patients who've had a transplant, the hazard ratio for CPX351 was about 0.5, so basically doubling the survival. And patients, even with this 5-year follow-up, median survival not reached in the CPX351 arm. And so if we go back and remember who these patients were in the trial. They were between the ages of 60 and 75 with secondary or therapy-related AML. I think the strategy of taking a patient with that profile, giving them CPX351 and going to transplant is still, I think, the standard of care because of these now proven long-term benefits as a result of this abstract.
Dan, any comments on some of the combination studies that are being done? Many of them were reported at ASH. We saw this one combining it with venetoclax. We also saw this VFAST master trial combining with various targeted therapies. And this one here combining with gemtuzumab. Any thoughts about these various combination strategy with CPX, Dan?
Yeah, you know, CPX is a tempting backbone for combinations, and I think there are a lot of ongoing investigations into this, and probably will continue to be. I think many of us have a sense that in the near future we're hoping to get more further away from intensive chemotherapy regimens, particularly for, you know, secondary AML patients for whom CPX351 is approved. And that's, you know, with respect to comparison to intensive chemotherapy. But that also is an area that venetoclax-based regimen seem to do very well in. And although at the moment those are two divergent populations, unfit and fit for intensive chemotherapy, like we said at the beginning, those will probably start to bleed together. So, I mean, I watch with interest all of these different combination therapies with CPX351, and it'd be interesting to see if there are differences there. And Eitan kind of talked about the long history of AML of combining other additional therapies with 7+3 type regimens. You know, CPX351 is a 7+3, at its heart. And so whether those strategies can or will be successful, we'll have to see.
So, Andrew, another drug we haven't talked about actually approved in the United States is Glazedejib, a hedgehog inhibitor. Curious, right now it kind of seems like it's taken a back seat to all these other developments in terms of where it might be headed, if at all. We saw this trial. I always love the trial in progress posters that are done, the GLAD AML study combining with Glazedejib with decitabine. Andrew, where do you see Glazedejib heading?
So Glazedejib in its registration study in combination with low-dose ARC produced a response rate of about 27%. And I think for hematologists, getting older patients into remission is incredibly important. And so I think the higher response rates observed with vein-based combinations, I think is perhaps the reason why the latter has taken root more firmly into the clinical setting. With respect to Glazedejib, obviously it did show positivity in a randomized trial. And really, we have to ask the question, what is the biology of how this was able to do that? Because many agents in the past have not been able to do that with respect to low-dose ARC combinations. And so clearly, there is something active about Glazedejib, whether it's against a progenitor or stem cell phenotype, and can we identify those patients, or should we give this in a more maintenance type of setting, perhaps now in combination with oral AZA or other possibilities? I think this is really the key question for this compound. Can we understand which patients benefit, and can we improve those response rates either in combination with other active agents like venetoclax or with other treatment settings like maintenance?
So there's a bunch of new agents we've already mentioned, but one in particular I just want to finish out with here, Eitan, is magrolimib. Can you comment on anti-CD47, how it works and what we know about it at this point, and also this abstract that was presented combining with azacitidine?
Yeah, so there's a lot of excitement about anti-CD47 targeted therapies, whether it's antibodies or fusion proteins. And the reason is because CD47 is expressed on macrophages and monocytes and sends a signal that basically keeps the macrophages and the monocytes from attacking leukemia cells or cancer cells in general. So if you can inhibit CD47, you can then sort of reestablish that immune surveillance of the macrophage and monocyte compartment to go after these leukemic cells. So there's a lot of excitement about this, primarily because in the setting of myelodysplastic syndromes, the combination of azacitidine and magrolimab, which is this anti-CD47 antibody, showed a very, very high response rate. So this study was done not in MDS, but in acute myeloid leukemia combining azacitidine and magrolimab. It had fairly high response rates in the range of 60%. And really what the company is trying to do is to position this combination as a P53 targeting therapy. The reason is because they see high response rate in the P53 mutant setting that are similar to the response rates you see in the P53 wild type setting. You would expect that to be lower. How this is going to play out is a little bit unclear. I think that, you know, looking at response rates alone, as I think I said previously, when it comes to these kinds of therapies in AML, is quite hazardous. Sometimes high response rates don't necessarily turn into increased overall survival, but it is a compound, and anti-CD47 targeting in general is a strategy that people are excited about, and there are at least five or six companies working on this.